Welcome, everybody. This is the first office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Economics of Obamacare. And this is just an office hours meeting. And so the rules here, as anything goes, we've got a few people logged in. So I know it's intimidating, guys, but this only works if you start typing in questions. So just go ahead and just ask away. No question is too silly. And then also, just for people who haven't done this before, in terms of the etiquette, I'm just sitting here fielding questions, and so I'm looking at the chat box. So if you have a question, don't think you're being polite and wait for me to wind down my answer, and then I'm done talking and say any more questions, then you type it in, because I don't know if there's a pending question. So just go ahead and type your questions, and then I'll adjust the length of my responses based on what's sitting in the queue, if that makes sense. So this works a lot more smoothly if all of you are typing in stuff. Like I said, don't worry about, you know, oh, man, my question, nobody else would care about that. It's better that you ask me questions than that we sit here. Okay, Kim Alexander says, Bob, you mentioned we can ask other topics during office hours. Yep, absolutely. Consistently defending peace from a libertarian perspective is not very difficult using the non-aggression principle and just war theory. However, neoconservatives always bring up World War II. What argument do you use when World War II is brought up as a justification for war? Okay, fantastic question, not least of which because if you guys are shy, I can talk for a long time on this one. But again, for people who are, I see some people are trickling in, go ahead and post your questions in the chat box here, and then I will get to them in the order in which they're posted. Okay, so let me just give the background here, because I know a lot of people may have just signed up for this course because they were interested in Obamacare and they wouldn't know necessarily about the broader context here that Kim's referring to. So the non-aggression principle is the central element in libertarian theory, at least the strand of libertarianism associated with Murray Rothbard, people who follow in that tradition. So it's not a one-to-one overlap by any stretch, but it is true that most of the Austrian economists or people who like Austrian economics associated with the Mises Institute or the people who go to Mises.org for their daily fix of free market economic analysis, that they are subscribers to Rothbardian libertarian theory. So as far as that, so that the non-aggression principle says that, are you guys, is my sound cutting out? Testing 1, 2, 3, is the sound okay? Okay, shoot. Let me see, let me try to close some of my browser windows. I'm not sure how else to deal with that. Okay, I closed a bunch of stuff, so hopefully that'll increase it. Okay, testing 1, 2, 3. Is this any better? Okay, hopefully that was it. I'm not sure let's give it another couple minutes, and then if it still is bad, I guess we can try to figure out what to do. But hopefully that helped. Okay, so the non-aggression principle is the central element of Rothbardian libertarianism, and that says that it is immoral to initiate force or fraud, in some phrasing of it, against somebody else. So that would be aggression. So you can't initiate force or fraud, but that doesn't rule out self-defense. Just to be clear, okay, so the non-aggression principle is not the same thing as pacifism. You could be a pacifist and believe in the non-aggression principle, but it doesn't necessarily go the other way, okay? And then just war theory is a separate doctrine. Still cutting out. Is that, am I cutting out on everybody here? Okay, the man. I don't know what the problem is. Let me try one thing. I don't know that it's. Let me try to reboot my my internet box on this end. You know, like you unplug it, and so just hang on for like 60 seconds, and let's see if that does it. All right, sorry. I'm sorry, guys.
classes.
Testing 1, 2. Can you guys see and hear me all right? Testing 1, 2, 3. Can you guys see and hear me? Okay, I have no explanation for what happened. Okay. Just so you guys know, I don't know if you've been typing in stuff in the chat box. I'm only seeing it from when I just came back. Okay, so meaning that if you typed in more questions, I don't see them. So I'm going to go back and start at Kim's question about World War II. And if anyone had typed in a subsequent question, you got to retype it because I don't see it on my end. Okay. So I'm sorry about that delay. I had to reboot my Comcast box, and hopefully we can at least get through this. And I will talk to the superintendent of this building and explain the situation that this can't keep happening. Okay, so the question was about World War II. For people who are just joining us, I see some people didn't see it either. The question was, how can you defend, as a libertarian who believes the non-aggression principle and just war theory, what do you do about World War II? That seems to be a really difficult case. Okay. And it's the, now Danny Sanchez is calling me because I asked him for help before. So it's, The World War One, actually, in case you don't not familiar with it, the history of it, is actually much easier to make the case against U.S. intervention. Okay. Sorry, I'm just checking my email to make sure nobody's still stranded in the other room. So with World War Two, though, it's difficult. So here's the way I would normally do it. Okay, so first of all, you could say, and here, this isn't like my expertise as an economist doesn't allow me to say this stuff, but if, you know, the question was asked, and so this is what I would say, just from my studying of history and reading other people on this topic, is that, look, what is the one way of describing what the goal was and why it was so essential that the United States entered World War II was that, holy cow, if we had done nothing, then there would have been a dictatorship that would have taken over Europe and killed millions of people. And so then you could say, okay, well, because the U.S. entered World War II, that allowed the Soviet Union to gain, you know, the power that it ended up having in the post-war era. And that was a dictatorship that took over half of Europe and killed millions of people, right? So it's, in other words, the people who are defending the U.S. entry into World War II, you know, what they're looking at, of course, is what Nazi Germany would have been able to get away with had the U.S. just done nothing. And, of course, yeah, that's horrible, but they're not seeing that by the U.S. entering that took the pressure off the Soviet Union and allowed them to survive, whereas had the U.S. not intervened, it's possible the Soviets would have been conquered by the Nazis, or at least they would have been much weaker and could not have then taken over Eastern Europe and so on. And so all the horrors of what the Soviet Union did and all the stuff in the Cold War, you know, arguably including, you know, the Korean War and Vietnam and all that stuff, it's possible that that was a consequence of what of the U.S. entry into World War II. Not that it's, you know, morally the fault of some, you know, U.S. soldier who's storming Normandy. It's not like it's his fault that Pol Pot kills people in Cambodia years later. But the point is, in terms of the consequences of U.S. foreign policy, certainly the Soviet Union was in a better position in 1946 because the U.S. entered World War II than they otherwise would have been. And so, you know, that's one thing. So in other words, it's not, you can't just take these things as isolated, just like the fact that Hitler was where he was. Well, that had something to do with the U.S. entering World War I. And so there's this, I don't know, sort of view of history in which the U.S. is just minding its own business and all these random horrible things just keep happening and they keep going and fighting noble wars and then coming back and minding their own business again. And the point is, you know, if you look at, you get the logic of interventionism, like on a domestic front, a lot of people at least understand the logic by which you could say, well, no, government intervention actually creates the very problems or exacerbates the problems that it's supposed to solve. And so that, you know, when liberal progressive Democrats come in and try to help poor people in the inner city, and they start doing this intervention, that intervention, and you as a libertarian economist can look back or step back and say, look, you're not helping these people. You're causing the very problems you think you're solving. People can make an analogous type of case. I mean, it's not identical, but make a similar type of case with U.S. foreign policy that, you know, the repeated use of U.S. tanks and bombers to try to fix things and provide peace actually keeps sowing the seeds for further conflict. And, you know, obviously that's like what Ron Paul says about the Middle East and so on. And so that's what I say with World War II. And then the other thing, too, is just, I mean, even a lot of, how can I put it? Even people who don't question the U.S. entry into World War II, still, even a lot of those people, like respected historians and even certain military strategists and so on, would say it was not necessary to drop the atomic bomb. That Japan was totally boxed in terms of, you know, the U.S. naval power had them confined to their home islands. They were not a threat at that point, and they were offering all sorts of means by which they were going to surrender. It's just they didn't want to do an unconditional surrender, and that the U.S. just kept pushing and saying, no, it's got to be an unconditional surrender, and they dropped two atomic bombs to get them to concede. And that, you know, so a lot of people are saying that that was not a military, it was not a tactically necessary thing to do. It was more about showing the world, look at our new bomb. And so this is why we're going to now be running the show here. So that's another aspect of it, you know, besides just the the broader question of World War II. We start getting into specifics, and I mean, there were a lot of horrible things, like the firebombing of Germany. That, I mean, it's where there was just deliberate destruction of civilian populations and stuff like that. Where it's just World War II is a very sordid affair. It was not just a black and white. There were bad guys and there were good guys. There was nothing that the Allied forces did that anybody should have any even second thoughts about. And like I say, Tim, I mean, in terms of just the consequences of whatever, I mean, they'll say stuff like, you know, a standard thing is say, oh, the lessons of World War II are that appeasement doesn't work and stuff like that. And you could argue that, but depending on how broadly you pull back, you could say, well, the lessons of the 20th century are that getting entangled in a European conflict like U.S. did in World War I is terrible, because then it sows the seeds for the rise of a dictator like Hitler. Because, I mean, again, this is not some, like, you know, crazy leftist anti-war nut job theory to suggest if the U.S. had not entered World War I, there would have been a negotiated peace, it would have been a stalemate, and that Germany wouldn't have gotten absolutely crushed and had a huge burden imposed on them in the Versailles Treaty. Whereas because the U.S. entered, that turned the tables, and now Germany really got crushed in World War One, and then had a pretty bad peace treaty foisted upon them. And then that sowed the discontent and the grumbling and paved the way for the rise of Hitler. So, you know, with all this stuff, we don't know what would have happened. Who the heck can say what would happen if the U.S. hadn't entered World War One? We don't know. Who can say, you know, would how many millions of people would have been slaughtered in Europe had the U.S. not entered World War II? Because, yeah, Hitler would have killed more, but Stalin would have killed more. So who the heck knows? But the point is, it's not as obvious as the neoconservative pundits would have you believe when they just make it sound as if it's a truism, self-evident, that the U.S. entering World War II saved lives. It's not obvious because, like I say, that's what allowed the Soviet Union to have such hegemony over so many people for decades, was that the U.S. came in and bailed them out against Germany. So, it would be great if there weren't dictators. I mean, so, and with all this stuff, too, people like try to make it sound like, oh, so you're fine with Hitler doing... No, I'm not fine with it. But the point is, just because you have an intention with your policy goal doesn't mean you're going to achieve it. Just like if you say, hey, you know, I don't think the U.S. government should be taxing people against their will and then using the money to send food stamps to people because I think that's immoral. If somebody says, oh, so you're fine with poor people starving, well, no, that's not it. It's just the means you're recommending to solve this problem. And so by the same token, I mean, what the U.S. government did in terms of standard morality was huge violations of the rights of American citizens during World War II. I mean, conscription, massive tax increases, massive inflation, all sorts of controls on the economy in order to send people, many of them against their will, overseas to get shot at and to kill people. And so even if you thought it was a noble goal of to liberate Europe, the means that the U.S. government used to achieve that are immoral if you're a libertarian, standard libertarian. So, and it also doesn't mean that the only correct response from a libertarian perspective would be that the U.S. just should have, that the American citizens, American people, should have just sat at home twiddling their thumbs. I mean, people would be allowed to voluntarily sign up and go overseas and fight or send money to the French resistance or whatever. And so, so there's that issue too, that it's not that if you're a standard libertarian in the Rothbardian tradition that you think that you have to be a pacifist. It just means it's not okay for the U.S. government to use its own violence to force people to pay for an undertaking order, let alone to make them pick up a gun and go get shot at in a place that they don't even know where, can't find it on a map, that's not the acceptable means to achieve what may be a noble goal, such as liberating people from, the German invasion. Okay, Andrew Esselbeck says, I read the reading assignment for Krugman who claims the market cannot cure healthcare. Is there any sector of the economy that Krugman thinks that the market can improve without government intervention? That's a good question, Andrew. The more I read Krugman, and as people may know, I'm not Krugman's biggest fan. And by the way, I'm not going to delve too deeply into the specific thing because we're going to talk about that Krugman article in the official lecture for the second week of this course, which is the week after Thanksgiving, remember. But Andrew raises a good point that because Krugman doesn't think the market can handle healthcare, I mean, is that some sort of obscure thing or unusual thing for Krugman, or is it pretty much he doesn't think the market can do anything? It's interesting because, yeah, the more he writes, the more he strays from conventional, even mainstream neoclassical economics and gets into things that a typical progressive leftist would endorse who is not trained in economics. And so, and if you know my blog, I mean, I try to document this all the time. And just in case you guys don't know this, Paul Krugman, back in the day, like in the 80s, and I think even in the early 90s, was a fairly conventional economist. And he, especially in regards to trade, he wrote some pretty, he wrote some essays that if you read it and didn't know it was Paul Krugman writing it, you would probably get all fired up and be like, yeah, it's good. And he even wrote some stuff during the Bush years. I recently documented this on my blog that I'm not exaggerating. If I had put Peter Schiff as the author and shown you the stuff, you wouldn't have batted an eye. You would have thought that Peter Schiff wrote it. Or, you know, it wouldn't have shocked you. And so, but particularly during the Bush administration, Krugman started turning, because the thing with the Bush administration is Krugman was criticizing the big deficits, and he was warning that markets, that we were, the Americans were living beyond their means, that markets eventually were going to turn on the U.S. economy, and the dollar was going to plunge, and interest rates were going to spike, and then the chickens would come home to roost from Bush's profligate policies. So, I mean, it was very Peter Schiff-esque in his analysis. But then, especially with the election of Obama, I mean, Krugman has just gone completely to the left, and on things like, to give you an example, like with environmental stuff, where Krugman is throwing out opposition to tariffs because he's saying, oh, well, saving the planet is more important than free trade. And so, I mean, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He literally said that. So, I mean, that's something, because the issue was, suppose the U.S. government and, like, the responsible countries in Europe have a carbon tax, but China or India don't care about global warming and they just want to boost their economic growth. And so they don't follow suit. And Krugman was saying, well, what we would do then is our governments would put a carbon tariff in place so that, like, if China's trying to send us stuff and we know that they're not correctly on their end making their producers pay a tax in accordance to how much carbon dioxide they're emitting, then before those TVs and cars come over our border, we impose a tariff on our end to adjust the price so that American consumers are paying the full social cost of the stuff they're getting. Okay, and then Krugman said, hey, and if such a carbon tariff violates the World Trade Organization rules, the WTO rules that are supposed to keep countries from engaging in tariff wars, that's what the whole point of the WTO is to lower trade barriers so that we get free trade. Well, it's not the whole point. Also, George Soros type stuff going on there too, but that's the ostensible purpose. And Krugman said in a column recently, so if these carbon tariffs violate WTO rules, so be it. Saving the planet is more important than free trade. That's like, I think, almost a verbatim quote from his article. So, I mean, that's not something that a real careful, anal economist would say. That's something that, like, a shock troop from Greenpeace would say, who doesn't really know much about economics. And so that's what I mean, that Krugman is like this battle he's been waging internally, where he wants to endorse all of the most far-out policy proposals that typical progressives who would have voted for Obama would support, and yet, you know, he has this cognitive dissonance where he has all this training as an economist, and some of these ideas are so nutty, and he has to come up with a clever way to try to justify them. So for a different example, even if you bought into all that green energy stuff and worried about global warming, the correct thing to do, the efficient thing to do, if you bought into all that, would be for the government to levy a carbon tax and not have the federal government handpick particular technologies. Like, you wouldn't have the EPA just say it's illegal to have coal-fired power plants and just ban it outright, or you wouldn't want to have the federal government giving loan guarantees to people trying to make better batteries for cars that can run on solar power or something like that to be able to replace, you know, conventional gasoline burning engines. You wouldn't want the bureaucrats micromanaging and picking winners and losers, because how do they know? It's like a Hayekian point, but it's even mainstream economics. they understand that, okay, if there's this negative externality from carbon dioxide emission, the way you deal with it is you put in a carbon tax, and then you let the market pick, you know, if coal-fired power plants really don't make sense, okay, the carbon tax will make them unprofitable and go out of business. But it's not that you would have the EPA just literally ban them, because they could be wrong. For all we know, maybe it does make. So my point is, Krugman still endorses all these nut job proposals from green advocates to have funding for, Solyndra and stuff like that, in the way, or to, you know, passing massive new regulations that everyone's got to increase their, the insulation on their buildings, right, for energy efficiency. So that's one of the things that within the last few years, EPA came out, and so now the building codes got tightened so that if you're building a new office building, you have to have more, better insulation so that your heating bills are lower and that kind of stuff. And yeah, again, the ostensible purpose is to save energy, to wean us from foreign oil, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions because it takes electricity to heat the building, all that kind of stuff. And so Krugman, you know, he should come out swinging against that and say, no, that's totally inefficient. You don't want to have top-down central planning. But he didn't. He was okay with it. And the way he justified it was to say, well, we're in a liquidity trap right now, so actually forcing people to invest more money is a good thing. In other words, like it was forced obsolescence. The EPA was saying the current buildings are not up to code, and so you got to just, you know, scrap them and start over. So he was admitting, yeah, normally that would be wasteful, but since we're in a liquidity trap, actually it's a good thing. So, I mean, that's what I mean. He's a clever guy. He can always come up with some reason that what the progressive environmentalists happen to want to do is okay. And like you see a similar thing with inequality. That clearly the kind of people that Krugman wants to impress really care about income inequality. And they want to tie it to the business cycle to explain, the reason we had the Great Depression was because in the 1920s there were tax cuts for the rich and the upper 1% got all this huge increase in their wealth, where the rest of the people kind of stagnated, and then blah, blah, blah. And the same thing during, you know, the Bush years, it was good for the fat cats, but the middle class suffered and the poor suffered, and that's why we're now suffering for the. And in the beginning, you know, Krugman was saying, you know, I'm sorry, guys, there's no way you can connect those two things. And yes, I wish there were more income equality, and yes, I think that there were horrible policy mistakes in the Bush administration that, you know, paved the way for this great recession, but the two really don't. But as time went on, he would keep softening that stance. He would keep brainstorming and coming up with more and more ways in which, well, you know, maybe you could kind of show that income inequality contributes. So that's what I mean, that he's always, Andrew, coming up with ways to circle back. So to answer your question, the more he writes, the more Krugman, his default position is government can help. So it's not like the other way around where it's, you know, market until proven guilty. It's now the other way around, that government intervention, unless you can come up with some really compelling reason why more government would actually hurt the situation. And of course, he may deny that. I'm not saying what I just said, that he ever wrote that out explicitly, but in terms of, if you see how he handles himself on issue after issue, I can't remember the last time I saw Krugman, calling out people in a major policy discussion that was underway. I can't remember Krugman ever siding with like the people who were on the Heritage Foundation side and saying, yeah, I don't like these guys in general, but on this issue, they're right, and we should let the market deal with it. I can't remember Krugman ever saying that within the last 5 years. Okay, we've got, what, just 10 more minutes? Randy says, how do retailers handle holiday hiring? The much longer hours they need to be open would seem to result in many part-timers working far more than 30 hours. I've been told the 90-day look back gives them the ability to do this. That's a fantastic question, Randy, and I apologize. I don't want to say something right now and then have to correct myself later. I should go research that a little bit more carefully. What we're going to do, just so you guys know, at some point in the next lecture, the official lecture for this course, we're going to walk through the exact details of major provisions in the Obamacare legislation, the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to spend probably a good 45 minutes going over just this kind of stuff. And so I'm glad you asked that, Randy, because that is a great thing to know. But instead of me saying something now that's not totally right, why don't we wait until I can cite chapter and verse from the actual legislation? Because the other thing, too, just so you guys know, part of the issue here is they passed the legislation, but then it's, you know, there's language that's open-ended and it's not obvious. Well, what does that mean when you implement it? And so then there's follow-up regulatory opinions given, or I don't know what the exact legal term is. And so, like, the thing with the, the crucial issue that we're going to talk about you can keep your insurance if you like it, you know, the thing that everyone's outraged about, and we're going to go over and see that back in 2010, there were internal memos where they were saying about how many of these policies actually would not be grandfathered, that they knew, that because the specific legislation was saying if a policy that was in force before the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was passed, that gets grandfathered in so long as it doesn't get changed. But once it changes, then it's no longer grandfathered, it's no longer protected, and then if it doesn't meet the standards of the ACA for newly issued policies, then, you know, it's inadmissible. And so the issue is, you know, so that's the legislation said, but then the question was, well, what do you mean if the policy isn't changed? Like, do they have to keep the premium the same? Because clearly, as the years go by, you would think just with normal price inflation, especially in the medical sector, that the premium might go up, or the coverage could go up, or the deductible. So, you know, the question was, what does it mean for the policy not to change? You know, or you could even say something even crazier, like, you know, what if you have a kid? And then you want to get your kid on the policy, well, you know, that clearly would change it. So what people would have thought it meant to say you get to keep your policy, that it's not obvious in practice if you're actually going to legally implement the thing, what does that mean? What counts as the same policy? What counts as them changing it? And so some of that stuff was coming out later in terms of the government just determining, you know, the regulators, okay, what are we going to do when we implement this thing? Or, so that, you know, that kind of goes back to Nancy Pelosi's infamous thing where she said we have to pass the legislation to find out what's in it. I mean, that is the case. When you do something like this, it's not just about the Affordable Care Act. Just in general, now when the government passes these humongous, like literally this big in terms of pages, legislation, things come up. There, you can't specify exactly every little permutation and possible scenario that's going to happen. And so you could, even in principle, you can't put that all down in the law so that the legislators, what they're voting on is the rules, and then everyone knows what the rules are. Some of it has to kind of be fleshed out in practice. And so, like I said, we'll go over that. Okay, Andrew says, is the healthcare industry, the insurance, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, for or against Obamacare? That's a great question, Andrew. I hadn't planned on getting into that stuff during the lecture, but let me jot a note to myself. Let me just answer off the cuff here. My recollection of what happened is that originally they were against it. And then there was a lot of behind closed doors meetings and people from the Obama administration. Shoot, I wish I could remember the guy. It was some head lobbyist that was like just like a slimy guy. Like that, it made a lot of progressives get queasy, realizing, oh wait a minute, this new guy Obama that we thought was our messiah, he's not the guy we thought. He picked this guy to meet with these people. It's the kind of thing where the guy's name's going to come to me the moment I turn off the camera, but right now his name is escaping me. But he headed up these consultations behind closed doors, and I believe he got them all to, because they were going to run attack ads, the pharmaceutical companies and so on, the health, you know, the major health insurance, they were getting gearing up to run a bunch of attack ads to get Americans to be scared to think, if this Obamacare stuff passes, your health, you know, your insurance is going to be awful. Rates are going to skyrocket. There's going to be rationing. There's going to be death panel. I don't know if we use the word death panel, but they were getting ready to really just throw millions of dollars into sabotaging this thing to make sure people told their representatives, do not vote for this thing. I don't want it. And so again, this is my recollection of what happened. I think the administration called them in and got them to realize, you understand, we're going to force everybody in America to buy your product. You get that, right? And then the insurance companies are like, oh, yeah, okay. And the pharmaceutical companies, too, like you're saying, look at how many more people are going to be buying drugs now because, you know, we're forcing them all to get insurance and everything, and we're throwing trillions of dollars into this. Okay, so you can see so that was how they got them on board. And then I'm thinking now, though, they're starting to regret what happened, especially, and we're going to talk about this next time, partly what's happening now with the sort of pullback where they're thinking about not putting in the individual Band-Aid, or, you know, they're postponing things because of the public outcry. So it's kind of like, all the stuff that hurts the insurance companies has already been implemented, but the stuff that was going to help them, namely forcing everybody to sign up, you know, now they're getting timid about, oh, gee, maybe we shouldn't do that. And so, you know, that's really where I think a lot of the insurance companies are realizing, what the heck were we thinking? We should have just opposed this thing at the beginning. But, you know, that's the kind of thing. How can I get inside the head of insurance executives? Okay, one last question here. What are the likely effects changes for consumers living in the members of this Pacific Pact member nations ironed out in Salt Lake City last weekend? Is the WTO going to be at loggerhead with this group's dictates? Will it supersede NAFTA? I think the WTO would go along with it. I think that those kind of high-level groups are coordinated with each other. But again, you know, I'm speculating on what's going on in the minds of people that I don't, you know, whom I don't know. And so how could I say? As far as superseding NAFTA, I don't know enough about it, okay, to be honest. So I think with all those things, I'll put it this way, nobody's going to raise an objection. Okay, I think the point of these supranational, what the adjective or the prefixes you want to use, is to get it so that no individual government even has legal standing to be able to stop what's happening. That they're trying to make it so that not even the U.S. federal government can veto something, and that they're trying to transfer sovereignty over the affairs out of the hands of individual governments and into bodies that are above individual nations. And so that way, like, the people in respective countries are even more removed from what's happening and have less direct control over it. Okay, and that's true whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing. Right, like if you're really for free trade and you really want there to be global free trade, you don't want individual nations having the ability to enact tariff barriers, right? Like that's, like I was talking to you a minute ago about Krugman, you know, having the WTO, if a bunch of governments all sign on, you know, sign various treaties and agree we're going to be bound by this organization that we agree can be an umpire in terms of saying, oh, wait a minute, this country levied a tariff against these guys, so that means you guys are allowed to levy your retaliatory tariff, you know, that kind of stuff. The point of that is to make it so that you don't want individual nations having the ability to have trade wars with each other. You want some third-party group that can effectively say to them, no, you're not allowed to put that tariff in place. Okay, so, you know, that's, or even like the idea of the UN or something. I mean, the point of that was to make it so that there could be some organization that had more power and authority than any individual government. So that if individual governments were starting to go to war with each other, this higher group could, like, knock them down and say, no, stop. So when a minute ago when I talked with what may have sounded like nut job conspiracy theory, I'm saying, no, the whole point of these organizations is to have more power than the individual nation making up. And so that's true whether you view them with, you know, suspicion and fear or whether you think they're great. That's their whole purpose, is to get nations to agree to things that might not be in their individual interest, but that all the nations agreed to it would be, right? Like so with trade barriers, it's obvious to everybody, even protectionists, that if all the countries right now have tariffs, all simultaneously reduce their tariffs, we'd all be better off. And so that's part of the function of these trade treaties. Okay, we'll stop there. I'm sorry, guys, for the technical snags. I'm going to talk to the owner of the building and try to get my internet up to speed. Or if not, I'll go somewhere else before the main lecture. So remember, we have Thanksgiving week off for this course, and then we'll be back the next week with our second lecture. Okay, thanks, guys.